Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
QNL.
With guest co-hosts.
Paradigm Shifter.
White Oak.
Daniel goes from sad face to angry face, and you don't want that.
Okay.
He almost killed me once. I'm scared of it.
You don't want to see an angry Canadian.
Hi, welcome to episode 96. I'm Paradigm Shifter with Dan Q.
Hello, everyone.
White Elk.
Howdy, folks.
QNL.
Something in between.
Makalura.
Uh-oh, caffeine container empty. Be right back.
And the main team.
I am unbalanced. The stupid thing with great generals defending. I kind of decided that I'm never going to use anything as a great general ever again except for a scout, because I'm just tired of that. That's such BS. You got a great general medic that has, like, almost no promotions at all, and it defends. Sure, if my stack gets wiped out, yeah, the great general just deserves to die, too. But it should not be defending as a medic over other options.
Well, they got combat one, because they got medic, so...
Or drills. But if you take drill, then it really screws things up, because then it's like, ooh, I have a first strike, so I should defend first, so that might even be worse. But the worst of all is Woodsman 3. As nice as that sounds, it's an awful idea. Because Woodsman 3 with the drill promotions, anytime you're on defensive terrain, your great general is going to defend first. Because the game really overvalues first strikes for defending. My favorite example, and I'll never forget it, is when Dan F., a while back when he was still on the forums a lot, he put a destroyer and an ironclad on a tile and gave the ironclad drill 4 and flank 2. And then he had a high drill destroyer attack. And there was like a combat destroyer and the ironclad with first strike immunity and a bunch of extra first strikes. And guess which one defended? Yeah, it wasn't the destroyer. Now, the destroyer, had it defended, would have had 70 or 80% odds or something like that. But no, the 30% less ironclad defended instead and was killed.
Because of the first strike.
Because of the first strike and the first strike immunity. The game perceived the ironclad as a superior defender. And if you put Woodsman Theory on your medic, there is a good chance that's going to happen to you. So no, I'm just going to use a scout from now on. That thing will almost never defend, and if it is defending, my stack is just about gone anyway. So... In the Senate, we discussed gold and the prospect of whether or not it is un- or imbalanced. We also discussed whether or not you should leave a trading partner who is potentially impossible to rush on the continent, and the New Buildings Club. Better be good with your military.
Under the miscellaneous heading, odds and ends on the artificial intelligences that are Ragnar, Mehmed II, Shaka, Montezuma, and Sitting Bull in Civ 4. From the Vault, 4 Green Fields.
In the research lab, we explored the topic of no more eternal wonders.
In Forum Talk, we talked about when do you stop building mounted units, and also what the best courthouse replacement is.
Welcome to the Senate, where we discuss game strategy.
Roby Extreme writes, gold imbalanced. So we all know that precious square with the shiny metal is great. I wouldn't actually consider it imbalanced if I didn't spawn in the first city's BFC. The wildest thing about it is how the game pays no attention to the terrain around the gold. It still gives you the same quality squares with or without gold. But come on, guys. It's like playing a level below when you work the tile. Although, one counter solution I thought the game devs might have is that even though it gives you a big boost with ancient techs, you actually don't need them all. Fishing are usually one of the agricultural, animal husbandry, etc., and by the time you're in classical age, the gold isn't substantial since you have more gold to go around anyway. I don't know. What do you guys think? End quote.
Well, on the one hand, there's a reason that people revolve Hall of Fame for triple gems all the time. And I would argue that gems are a better tile. But on the other, the surrounding land is probably a bigger factor than the gold in the start. For example, I would take no gold and maybe even just the plains cow, like the total trash start, if it meant that I had Gandhi and Mansa Musa as neighbors as opposed to, say, Shaka and Gilgamesh. It's hard to tell with your initial start just how imbalanced it is. as good as your start may be, some AI out there might get 25% of the land to their own and without war and just totally screw you over regardless of a good start. Or it might look bad, but then you can rush somebody else who had a good start with chariots or something and wind up in a really, really good position early on. And yeah, probably on average, it's nicer to have gold than not to have gold, but I don't think it's that big of a deal.
Tends to be low food as well, doesn't it, really? I mean, it's normally a low food tile gold, so you've got to grow to about 3 size, normally, I find, and get a worker to improve your food resource, which is a bit of a hassle, but it's worth it when you get libraries up.
That's why gems are more popular, I think. They're only a marginal reduction in commerce, and they have 2 food on them if they're flat land or just 1 if they're on a hill. But even so, it's better than gold.
Gems are rare as well, and you're normally in the jungle, which is pretty good once you get iron working.
Yeah, and because you have gems, you can easily get iron working.
Yep.
They're probably one of the best starts.
That's what I say, gems better than gold. Ladies like them more as well.
Gems may be better, but also the point, generally when I see 1 gold, I'll see a couple of them. And starting out right off the bat with a gold on a hill, that helps with the production. Oftentimes I want the choice to get my commerce heavy tiles going right off the bat, get a couple quick techs to set me up for whatever the situation I'm facing. So at the start, having some commerce and a little bit extra hammers like a bonus, a hammer I wouldn't normally have chosen, but because that commerce is there and I want that commerce to give me a quick jump start, that's just a little extra.
Irrigated corn, I would argue, is better than either of these things. Especially riverside corn is 1 commerce, 6 food. Once you get biology, 7 food. That is a huge lift to your, well, to your early production ability to expand, and it's very flexible. And not only that, it's one of the best health resources. I would say the grains are the best health resources. So if I can get like 2 irrigated corns, I'm happy. Even if I don't have anything else in the capital's fat cross, that's viable. As long as there's some river there and there's 2 corns, that makes me smile.
Well, food is king. Pigs on a hill is pretty good as well.
Yeah. Oh, any pigs is good.
The extra happiness that you get from gold is pretty nice, although, I mean, you do also get that for gems. Pretty advantageous to have forges if you have gold and gems. Well, duh, right? What extra happiness? Usually earlier in the game, the happy cap is more important than the health cap, for example, because that doesn't kick in until later.
Yeah, if you have multiple gems, you might want to go for an early shot to metal casting in some fashion, especially in Austria.
I think we can all agree that silver on a tundra hill is bad. Although it's very rare.
It's worth settling, but just for the happiness.
So I agree. Gems would be perhaps more imbalancing than gold, but still gold, pretty nice bonus to start out with, all things in balance. Depending on how far the AIs are away, what your terrain outside the big fat cross looks like, it could be a little bit imbalancing. But then I like the imbalance factors of these extremes, these things that occur randomly. So each game's a bit different. It's nice to have a really commerce-heavy city, or to have an opponent, an AI opponent, that is, start out with a big bonus like that, because that's going to change things up.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with that, as long as the map is still, like, reasonably winnable. What I really hate seeing, and I've already mentioned it once, I believe, that you'll get, like, an AI with a 3-gem start, and then it'll expand to, like, 25% land on a standard map, where the average civ should be getting around 14%. That's a big problem on higher difficulties because their production just gets out of control then, and it's very difficult to stop that. But is gold and gems imbalanced? Not really. It varies a little bit between single and multiplayer also. If you're playing against somebody and they get horse and you get gems, that might not be so good because they're going to come pillage your gems and then you won't have anything. I think gold and gems have their place in the game, and they're not going to be out of control starts every time you get them. Leave a trading partner on the continent. This was started by Bill the Cat. Bill the Cat, as in, you know, Bill's the cat. Just to be specific. Background. Started up in Emperor Fractal Game, standard size Marathon. Ooh, military. Haven't beat Emperor yet. Playing as Augustus Caesar. And ended up on a smaller continent with Sitting Bull and Gilgamesh. He's saying that Gilgamesh has no access to metal, and he didn't want to get them led to the point where he might get it, so he wiped them out. Okay, so he rushed a protective leader. And now he's saying that Sitting Bull has some bronze and is building up dog workers. What's a dog
worker?
This is what I really wish Polycast had some fan art, I'm telling you. But anyway, he's afraid of City Bolt's dog workers, and he still thinks he should easily be able to wipe him out since he's behind in tech. But
I don't know. Those dog workers are efficient.
I just have this mental image of a little puppy pulling a plow.
Got to hand it to them dog workers, though. I mean, they're loyal. They put their nose to the ground and keep on trucking. Yeah, they're good workers.
They just keep going.
Yep.
Basically, what Build-A-Cat wants to know is, should you leave a trading partner on a continent when it's just you and the other trading partner and they're backwards? My answer to that is it depends. Unless it's Mansa Musa or you can get them the friendly, they're not going to be very valuable for technology trades. But on the other hand, capturing their cities early might cost you in terms of your research and maintenance. Whereas if you don't go to war with them and they're not Tokugawa, you can probably get open borders and at least get some trade route commerce from them while you're teching to astronomy and maybe take them down later. Especially in the case of somebody like Sitting Bull, protective leaders who spam units like crazy and make themselves really hard to deal with. Dog soldiers, to be differentiated from dog workers, are actually pretty good against Praetorians. So I probably wouldn't go there. Sitting Bull's pretty peaceful. He's like a 90% no-war probability at cautious. He will not declare it pleased or friendly, and he'll open border. So there's really no reason to take him out unless he's just walling off all the land or something. When you're in a continent with someone like that, I would probably leave him alone and just build up the land you have first and then take them out after they've developed their land for you.
Sitting Bull opens borders so that he can keep poisoning your water every other turn.
Well, that's true. But I don't think it's worth taking him out over it yet.
Yeah,
I don't disagree that he probably has to die, but he doesn't have to die to Praetorians when he's dog soldiers.
Yeah, horse is much better, really. Horse, archers, chariots.
Yeah, but it's still painful with those totem pole archers. It's just obnoxious. And this isn't like a speed chariot rush where he hasn't had the chance to set it up yet. This guy's already attacked Gilgamesh, of all things, for his first target. I know it's Marathon. He could probably get away with it, but still.
Yeah. Sitting Bull doesn't even need any metals for dog soldiers.
Nope. Nor does he need them for City Garrison 3 archers. Hooray. Yep. His longbows are even more fun.
If you're going to take him out, you've got to do it before he gets longbows, really. Or until you've got gunpowder.
Yeah.
And he hasn't. Tends to be a bit backwards, really, Sitting Bull.
Yeah, he does not tech well because he spends too much of his commerce on espionage, which is how he keeps poisoning your water. He makes a lot of demands, too.
But he does spam units.
Yes. Yes, he builds as many units as Montezuma does. That's kind of scary. 35 unit prop. Only Shaka, Ragnar, Napoleon, and Mehmed are higher. 40 unit props.
No buildings club. What? I mean, I like the idea of it. How about that?
Yeah, it's a good idea.
This user named Oppy, O-P-P-Y, decided to hold a forum game in which you are not allowed to build buildings. The leader is Suryavaryaman II of the Khmer, and I shouldn't actually say how people have been doing because that's a spoiler, right? But sounds a little bit whoa to me. It's really scary to me to like build without buildings. Like, what am I going to do without my barracks, without my granary? Oh my god, without a granary? There's corn and no granary? Oh gosh.
Oh come on, it's only noble. Just build units and capture everybody, and then you're done.
I mean, one could argue that an always war game is pretty much a no buildings game anyway.
You can probably get away with not doing that on Noble, I think, so there you go. Just horse archer rush everything, and you're done.
Run to currency, like Rollo says.
Yeah, currency or alphabet would be a big deal.
No barracks is pretty bad, though.
Well, I would say no granary is worse than no barracks.
Yeah. Well, no granary is worse than everything, really.
I would think that there'd be a challenge of running out of things to build because you'd have so many units that you wouldn't be able to afford to pay them. So either you got to get action right away and start losing units and gaining cities, or you're going to end up deleting units, I imagine.
Actually, this is the common problem people run into on higher levels with overexpansion when they don't do it properly. The things you really need in normal games are pottery and writing. But in a game like this, I think it'll help with open borders, but you probably don't want to prioritize it as much if you're not going to be using it for great people points. But you need a converter. You either need alphabet or currency, so you can build wealth or build research. That's how you avoid building units, too many units. So to get there, you have to balance what you're building between settlers, workers, and military. But if you choose your tax properly, especially since noble maintenance isn't all that impressive, it's actually pretty little, and you at least have a decent number of commerce cities, you should be able to get there in reasonable time. It's really not that bad, at least the alphabet.
I would imagine that getting pottery is probably definitely really a priority, just because I don't really know how you would work this without a cottage economy. What would be the point of running specialists if you can't build buildings to multiply their effects, you know?
Well, you go for code laws, don't you?
Mysticism and casts. Cast is really the only way you're ever going to get a specialist, by the way. Do that for some bulbing to trade. But on noble, there's not going to be much to trade for. You're really just better off killing everything.
You're not going to go after whip buildings, are you? You're just going to whip troops, which aren't that expensive, really.
I wouldn't. Not on granaries.
Yeah.
Maybe when your cast is really low still, but after that, no way.
Yes, you need to go for a cast system, really, don't you?
I would just work mines, and I can work mines, and I always work cottages. It's going to get really expensive. Not right away without courthouses, but after a while, even on noble, when you have like 30 cities and no courthouses, it can be a little pricey. I still remember Mad Scientist's roleplay challenge where we weren't allowed to build courthouses or tech code of laws. And that was a little dicey. We won it. Well, I won the first one, he won the second one, because he had to redo it. Can be done, but it gets pricey. You get to really balance what you're doing between military and building wealth.
Building wealth from research has got to be the key. That doesn't get multiplied by buildings except forge.
Plus the setup time is much shorter.
Yep. Hammer economy for the win, then, looks like.
Yeah. When you're given almost no other option, sure.
Yeah. Too bad you can't build forges.
Yeah. All my comments about this topic are just, too bad you can't build buildings in this no buildings game. Nah, that sucks.
The only one that really hurts is the granary. That hurts so much. It takes away whipping efficiency, takes away growing the city on the good tiles. That's the one building that I just would not want to do with that. But in that game, you can. So there you go. Learn to deal without it.
Libraries are pretty vital buildings as well.
Yeah, they're close. Not as important as the granary, but still pretty close. Most people don't think about Ragnar, but or Mehmed.
Ragnar's easy to get friendly because Hereditary Rule's his favorite civet.
Although it can be a little rough if you spawn only with him on the continent, because there's a good chance it'll hit you before you get him there.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to turn up much in my games.
Yeah, he's usually not that good of an AI. He needs a favorable start, really. Whereas Shaka and Mehmed are consistently nasty. Unless they get really shafted on their starts, they're pretty tough.
Shaka's definitely the worst.
Yeah, I hate Shaka.
Because he texts quite well occasionally, and Montezuma is amusing with his enormous stacks of Jaguars when you've got rifles. He's not much of a threat, really, I don't think. Although he is very annoying in that he, I'm pleased with you.
His only real threat is early in the game. He'll declare on you and slow you down so that some other AI will beat you instead because you've been hampered for the 50 turns or so by him being annoying.
Well, I've had him land big stacks of cavalry.
Yeah.
When he's overseas. There's one thing with Monty, he's always going for the human, he's not...
not always.
Well, no, Beyond the Sword made that a lot better.
Yeah, he really hates the high P-fleet people, like Sitting Bull or Elizabeth or those kinds of, or Hammurabi. They start with annoyed with each other, so they are pretty much like magnets when it comes to that.
He just hates everyone, though.
Yeah, but I love seeing Sitting Bull. Unless I'm on an island only with Sitting Bull, I love seeing Sitting Bull. Because I know that anytime I meet Shaka or Genghis Khan or any other asshat, they're going to go after Sitting Bull. Because they're going to hate him from turn zero, and that's awesome. And Sitting Bull isn't somebody who easily dies either.
He doesn't.
Over and capitulate in 2 seconds like Gandhi might.
Yep, he's quite handy for that. Keeps the AI busy with the wars because they're totally inept at fighting. And he's got city garrison free archers.
Yeah, and he builds enough units to live.
And he's awkward, yeah, so. But I'll join in. If anyone says, do you want to join in, attacking Sitting Bull, I'll go, all right then.
Well, Sitting Bull's winning, then you join in against the others.
Yeah.
I saw that once, that was crazy. One of my Nobles Club's games back when I was hosting them, I think it was Montezuma, I'm not sure. But Ragnar like declared on him and his stack failed, and Sitting Bull just kicked his ass. Now, I met Sitting Bull, he was 40% world pop. I'm like, what the hell?
Holy
and
crap.
Ragnar's like a one city vassal. Like, oh my god, what happened here?
He'll still poison your water when you're his war ally, though.
Yeah, he still will. I don't think he does it at friendly, but he'll do it any other time. But he was overseas, and they don't poison water overseas, thank god, so I didn't have to deal with that. And he was pretty backwards, even with like 40% of the world's pop, but not as backwards.
What's he like for bribing into war?
I think you need to be friendly with him. He won't declare on people he's pleased with, so he's not very easy to bring into war.
You just know everything. You've memorized the entire...
Not all of it, but I guess from looking at it from time to time and getting used to it, I started to remember things. Played a lot of games, so that's mostly it.
Shaka tends to send in a big stack of 20 units or so, like, and loads of cuirasses, and Shaka's just annoying anyway. And Monty. Monty with his big stacks of Jaguars.
Monty can be a problem when he's on another continent and he gets a little bit advanced. Like, say he has, like, a stack of 80 cavalry. That's a little annoying.
Yeah.
Because even if you have infantry and artillery, they can still rough you up because they're usually, you know, combat 2, combat 3, and there's just so many of them.
This is a Vault segment with topics cut from earlier episodes but have found relevance again later.
From episode 83 with Dan Q, to me and team, Kamikaze, Heraclitus, MMC, Peach Rocks, and QNL.
The four green fields also seems like an interesting topic. I actually played this, and it's really interesting.
I haven't had a chance to yet, but I want to.
Well, isn't it basically create a map and the map script or whatever screws up and you end up with nothing but grassland with a single river going down it? It looks like it's basically one of those.
Just without the river.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's nothing but grassland.
Hanging gardens are really important in that game, and I noticed Infinite City Sprawl seems to actually work a bit, because you can't get big cities, right? So you have to just settle a whole lot of cities. Obviously, a specialist economy doesn't work on that map either, so it's all cottage spam.
Yeah, or workshops, but it takes too long to get workshops.
Yeah, where you have absolutely no production other than, what, the one production in the city itself, just by the fact that you have to have at least the one, and then you're looking at having to do a lot of whipping until you're able to build workshops. I guess what you want to be able to do is get a settler as quickly as possible, so you probably want to have your city grow to at least a size 2 or maybe even a little higher than that, then switch to a settler, and then whip, and then hopefully as you're exploring you find better land. But if I remember this thread correctly, isn't the entire map like that though?
Would growing to 2 and whipping actually help get your settler faster in this case? I'm not convinced. I think you'd actually do just as well just build it right away. But I would actually suggest teching for pottery first and starting with a worker and then just cottaging everything you can.
Yeah, that's pretty obvious.
That's pretty much the only approach that you can use for a long time.
A religion is also more useful if you don't have resources. Religion's pretty good for happiness since you can basically get away with unhealthiness as long as it isn't a production city.
I think production cities will be emancipated, universal suffrage, cottage. Free speech would be good too, obviously, if you're cottaging, but your economic civic doesn't matter nearly as much.
True, but on the other hand, free speech isn't necessarily overpowered. You have nationhood, which is very useful if you don't have a lot of shields. I mean, just drafting an army becomes a very interesting option.
You won't regrow very easily, though.
It doesn't matter.
Well, yeah, I guess. What I'm saying is that the hammers you'd get by combining rush buying with the hammers from the towns, you might not want to draft away the town then. You might just want to work the town so you can get more units.
Okay, that is true.
Of course, at that point, like if you can actually get to state property, you could consider just workshopping everything, and then your production would be incredible.
Very true.
The AI is coded that it won't go into war plans unless it can create two kinds of offensive units. Four green fields, yeah, there's no strategic resources to make multiple kinds of offensive units at any time early in the game.
Can't you just pick AI opponents that don't need resources to get offensive units?
You could, but I don't think he did.
Well, he should.
And even there, the Jaguar is just one kind of offensive unit. So what would Montezuma's other offensive unit be? Archers don't count.
Maybe a simple change to that could be that you would allow resources. Give each player a single source of iron, for example, or horse.
That would be interesting.
The whole point of this was to work with no resources, though, right?
Pretty much.
No resources and crappy terrain.
Well, there's nothing wrong with the terrain if it had resources. Green grass is very nice.
Actually, even irrigation would be very nice.
What you want in a flat game like that is you start to wish that Civ 4 had the mechanic that Smack had, where you could raise and lower the terrain.
Terraform. Civ 2 had full terraformation, if I remember right. You could, like, turn deserts into grasslands and grasslands into hills.
With the engineer unit, yes.
Yeah, the engineer unit. I actually like that.
Come on into the research lab, where we explore concepts that are not in Civ yet, but maybe in the future.
Soundwave is the start of a thread about no more eternal wonders. He points out that it's rare that we see the ancient wonders today because they've been destroyed by natural disasters, wars, and revolutions or what have you, so why in Civ do they last so long? He also wanted to add some income due to tourism.
It doubles in culture value after 1,000 years. They are worth 8 person points, so that's something.
These mechanics are already built in-game. You can destroy the wonders by raising the city, and when you invade a city, the wonder loses all its cultural value anyway. And most wonders go obsolete at some point, so they have no effects beyond culture. So, I don't know. I don't really see a problem with this.
Also, most of the wonders that don't obsolete actually are still around today.
Yeah.
Like pyramids, they're kind of here. I don't know if Egypt can run any government civic it wants to. I mean, I would imagine it could, not because of the pyramids, but the pyramids are there. China's pretty safe from barbs, so there you go.
Unless they come through the internet.
Oh, nice one. That's nice.
Well, the Great Wall never helped much against pirates, you see.
pirates.
Jury 6 had a suggestion about why not include a very small chance that a wonder will be destroyed on capture, much like normal buildings can be. Whatever happens, the risk of losing wonders, however small it might be, would further increase the priority of protecting wonder-heavy cities. The prospect that you can just recapture them all would be null.
The Colossus only lasted 56 years before an earthquake brought her down.
That's great info.
I thought it was interesting. A lot of the other wonders still stand in one form or another.
Yep. Bay Library's gone, though.
Gardens, because that doesn't obsolete as far as I know.
Some people question if it even existed or if it was purely poetic.
Boney M. did a song about it. It's got to exist.
It exists in people's hearts. There you go. And it can make you more healthy just thinking about it. I don't think many people give up a Wonder City easily regardless. If you're getting something that strong taken, you're in serious trouble. This game is already very, very highly defensive-oriented until very late in the game. You don't really see a strong offensive surge until post-industrial. Like, once you get modern era and you have the metal navies, you have fighters, you have nukes, then finally the person on offense has an advantage. But for the rest of this game, the defender has an advantage consistently. And I don't like things that add more strength to the defense, even if it's minor in Civ 4. It's so strong already with collateral initiative and you have extra movement in your own territory.
I wouldn't mind so much if there was a small chance that it could be destroyed on capture. As much as I like random events I just mentioned in the thread, I definitely wouldn't like to have the random event to find out that your wonder was destroyed. Had an earthquake, and your wonder was destroyed. I had to pause for a moment because I thought, would then that mean that another Civ could try to build it then? So if I lost the wonder by a turn, I could cross my fingers, please have a random event, please have a random event, they lose it. I know how I'd feel if I was on the receiving end of, and the fact that, you know, you can disable random events. But anyway, I do like the idea of the possibility of being destroyed on capture, and in part, as was already said, if you built the wonder yourself, you should be protecting that city very well. And if you lose that, then you've got some big issues. I guess the only thing that it could end up being is if you capture a city that's wonder-heavy, and it's on the front, and maybe perhaps you don't lose a wonder then, but then when they take the city back, they lose a wonder in the process of taking it back, which you could say, well, it's kind of annoying that they took the city back, and they've got it back, but it's not quite as shiny as it once was. I really don't have a problem with that.
It wouldn't be a factor in most of my games. I seldom care when I'm on offense.
This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot Civ issues in the forums.
When do you stop building mounted units? This is a question from I.M. The two movement points are nice for speed, so until I have a two movement unit like tanks, I'll keep some mounted units in the stack and build replacements. I also find myself building more mounted units than I used to. They can move fast to defend threatened cities or pillage captured workers. You get two promotions from Barrack Stable without running any war civics, and the flank promotion increases survivability. So his questions in the poll, I always love thread with polls. There are eight of them, and currently winning is, once infantry are on the map, stop building mounted units more than twice the number of votes for next, which is once tanks are on the map, followed by once riflemen are on the map. The one thing that they have in common, of course, is when unit X is on the map, and you're talking later on in the game. That is consistent with me, I guess. Really, it's when do I stop building mounted units? It's more often a question of when don't you build mounted units, and that's when I'm lacking for horse early on in the game.
Yeah, I don't understand the three people that said never build them. What? What? How do you... Never?
They must have the worst RNG luck ever.
Yeah, well, basically, I mean, you just have to play at a lower level or you have to have some sort of metal. And I don't know if I really like gambling for that.
When we say stop building mounted units, the question is open to some interpretation, which is, are the mounted units really your primary army? Are you actually using them for offensive purposes, which I think is pretty much their strength? Or they can be used for defensive purposes, but man, that's a lot of micro.
How so?
Well, just in the sense about not receiving the defensive bonuses, just being open to that depending upon the tech level of the opponent that you're at. I mean, they're still good for defense, don't get me wrong, but I just consider them their strength to be more in the offensive realm.
Yeah, you just have to attack with them when the person gets right next to your city, flank all their siege.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I need to be paying attention to that.
Oh, come on now.
Rather than just letting them sit there and, oh yeah, I don't need to worry about doing anything with them. They're just defending. Just sit there. I don't actually, you know, I actually have to give them the order.
We're talking like really, really, really low tier micro here. And you select stack of horse archers, control click on the horse archers, and start and like right click on the enemy stack, and you're done.
Still, it presupposes that you really have to be paying attention to which cities are there. If you have just a chariot in a city and there's like a stack coming, I can see where Dan's coming from in this regard.
It's kind of hard to miss a big stack in your territory, though. I don't know.
It depends on the circumstance, right? Depends what else is going on. Knowing that mounted units are susceptible to that, if you've got other units on the tile, that it's not just mounted units, whether it's in a city or not, then that's different. Then I'm less concerned about actually being able to, oh, shit, I got to remember I need to attack them rather than have them attack me. But in any event, as I said, when do you stop building mounted units? It depends on how well promoted my mounted units are and whether I've got the pinch promotion or not, which is plus 25% per gunpowder units. But definitely by the time infantry come about, I'm not going to be building them anymore. But I'm not going to say, oh, well, I'm not going to use them anymore. I'm just not going to be making any new ones anymore.
So that's also when I pretty much stop building, and that's what I voted for. I'll still use whatever mounted I have, even like cuirassiers and stuff that's old. But I won't build new ones in the infantry era because once you start seeing artillery and whatever, you can't flank siege anymore. Yeah. They're reasonably cost effective against infantry in the field, but they're not so good attacking infantry in cities. And by then you just have better options offensively. A lot of different options that are superior to them.
So better than rifles attacking infantry, surely. That's what I voted.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If you're like behind and you're building something to try to stay alive, although that's attacking infantry. If you're running city garrison, the rifles are probably a little better.
Yeah, maybe, but infantry with a 25% bonus.
But if your fortification can nullify that, so that's just a question of your city garrison. So you can easily get, what's it, 0.5, almost 0.5 from city garrison too. So you're going to be fighting around 20 strength, whereas the highest the cavalry can get, even with the pinch promotion, it won't be there.
Yeah, that's on the defense though, isn't it? On the attack. Rifles are useless.
Absolutely, the cavalry are much stronger. But you really don't want to be fighting the war like that.
They get mad chickenry though, don't they, when they take it? And there's
more defensive thing, because they get an instant upgrade when they're on defense. If they are attacking you and then they tech, they can't really do that, fortunately.
The other thing mounted units good for is defending your own borders, because they can move so much faster than everyone else, especially with engineering.
Oh yeah, definitely. If there's like a stack coming... One thing I do like about cavalry and other mounted units is that after you attack, you can still move them to another tile, so you don't lose as much time between cities if you're attacking. That's a nice advantage, and just leave sort of the wounded soldiers in the city to heal.
That is a huge advantage because you will fight less units if you use a high-mounted stack without anything else in it and just quickly blitz the cities. You'll probably see on the order of 5 to 10 less units if you're attacking 3 cities that way. It's a big deal, and people don't account for that. A lot of people don't. Even with one move units, they IL whip when you're 2 tiles away. And that's why mounted are so much better than people perceive them, because the AI has significantly fewer turns where it can whip extra garrison, not to mention all the other units it's building in its other cities. So that moving point really helps. You see less units consistently because of it. They get one turn, and then you're in the city that they consider the city threatened. So they might whip one thing instead of 2 things or 3 things or even more if you've been barred.
I'm glad they got rid of the 10% city attack penalty for horse archers in Warlord. That was bad.
Yeah.
They're good at stealing workers with knights as well.
I hate that. The automated workers will move into known danger tiles.
Oh, yeah.
And they will split off 1 or 2 mounted units from their attack stack just to go get the workers.
Yeah, and not only that, the AI can see anywhere its units can move, even if it's in the fog. So the AI will suicide run a knight into your territory where it couldn't possibly see just to get your damn worker. It's like, come on. This is bullshit.
I am, sirs. What is the best courthouse replacement? Courthouse, standard to most civs, minus 50% maintenance, 120 hammers, available at Code of Laws. Rathouse, Holy Roman Empire, minus 75% maintenance, 120 hammers, available at Code of Laws also. Then we got the Sacrificial Altar, minus 50% maintenance, minus 50% anger duration from whipping, only cost 90 hammers, Code of Laws also. And then we got the Ziggurat of Sumeria, minus 50% maintenance, 90 hammers, but that's available at Priesthood. He goes on to say, I'm split on this, and wonder what you all think. I like to play a Sumerian, so I use a Ziggurat. In the long run, Rathouse would likely be better, but the Sacrificial Altar has a lot of synergy with Montezuma's spiritual trait. Overall, I vote for Ziggurat. It comes earliest, and you can make a run at the Oracle, since you're already teching that way.
I gotta say that these are all candidates for the top 10 unique buildings. They're all very good. So it is a little harder to pick in this poll than it might be in others. They're all very strong buildings.
I agree.
Now, I'm in the somewhat minority because I selected Sacrificial Altar.
I picked that too.
That's mine as well.
Reduced hammer cost, but that whipping duration is a really big deal. There's no other unique building that essentially increases your production so much so early in the game. It's just incomparable for a production increase.
It's great, and it's cheaper. What are they thinking?
Yeah, you can completely alter your city placement strategy to take advantage of the Sacrificial Altar in one pop whips. There's just no other thing that's like that. On water maps, it'll usually outperform the dike because you get it sooner and you can just constantly whip and fish cities without having to worry about it. You get a lot more total production from it than you would from the dike, and people don't seem to realize that.
Hmm.
I might vote it best unique building, and if it's not, it's very close. So that's the one I went with. A lot of people like the others. I can understand that, especially having 75% reduction on maintenance for corporations later in the game. I don't use a lot of corporations lately, but...
I would say that the Rathouse is my favorite just because of 75% reduction in maintenance. You get it at the same time, and it doesn't actually help that much early game, but I really love having the Rathouse, especially if you're having like huge empire and maintenance can really kill you.
Ties in real well with the trait, imperialistic half-cost settlers.
I agree.
If you can make it there while you're still spamming cities.
Yeah.
No, I agree. It's an excellent, unique building. My only issue with it is on most difficulty levels, it's not that big a deal. It's really only the higher ones where maintenance really starts to hurt. I would say probably Emperor Plus is when you really start having maintenance dig into you and you spam cities. Even so, it's pretty useful. Especially for a civ that doesn't have a lot of economic help otherwise, it's a nice lift.
Overall, they're all good.
Even the courthouse is good.
Yeah.
As came up in this thread, has already come up in this discussion, a lot of people in talking about their favorite courthouse replacement will relate that to the rest of the civilization that it's associated with. As someone who plays unrestricted leaders, I really don't take that into consideration quite as much. Monarch level player, I would still say put Sacrificial Altar first. Definitely if I'm starting in the Ancient Era and the Medieval Era as well. If it was Industrial and Modern Era, I might be more inclined, particularly on the higher difficulty levels, to go with the Rathas, to say it's my best courthouse replacement, in my opinion. But I can count on one hand the number of times I started on anything later than Ancient, so... with the exception of that circumstance, definitely Rathaus coming in at second, being the minus 75% maintenance, but for the whipping point, as well as the fact that it's 90 hammers. The Ziggurat, yes, it's available earlier, and it is cheaper, so it's not that it's bad. Definitely take it over a regular courthouse, but in comparison to the Sacrificial Altar and then the Rathas, for those reasons, I'd still place them ahead of it. I don't know about the people who are selecting courthouses, fine with me. Actually, the way the poll is written, you could say that a courthouse is fine with me. You could actually check that and one of the other ones as well, just the way that it's phrased. It says best courthouse replacement. A courthouse is fine with me, but if I've got a choice for one of the other three, I'm going to choose one of the other three.
Well, sure. That was not a well-designed poll from a research standpoint. You were absolutely correct. And I agree with you about later on, because you kind of start with courthouses in later starts, so the hammer differential isn't even that big a deal, and the maintenance can be a much bigger deal, potentially.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 441-212-88-7659. That's 441-212-88-POLY.
You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net. I do think that if you're a Civ player and you're a Scrabble player, you should have an in-house rule that if you spell Polycast and then Scrabble, that's quadruple score. If you're a true Polycast fan, you will do this.
It probably will be worth a lot of points, especially using the 7 letters to get it.
It has to be quadruple score. It has to be overpowered. It has to be game-breaking.
Yeah, that'll be game-breaking because there's no such thing as a quadruple score.
I have a hard time using up all 7 letters at once, though.
You can bridge 2 double word scores, and then you get a quadruple score. I did that the other day.
That's not very easy. You can do it sometimes, but if you're playing one-on-one, most people aren't going to let you get that too easily.
Okay, so...
Somebody's keeping us moving along. Got a hot date?
Now, Dave, Lisa's a woman, so she is the hot date. What do you mean?
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
What, you're saying that guys can't be a hot date, potentially?
Hey. I'm offended. Not me.
Not those that play Civ. Sorry.
What? Playing Civ adds to the appeal, obviously. I don't know what you're talking about.
Only in women.
Yeah.
Then it's exponential.
Goddamn double standard bullshit.
Well, thanks all for listening to another episode of the Polycast, number 96 in the series. They must be doing something right. The cornerstones of Polycast, we've had Daniel Quick.
But which corner am I?
Makalua.
Uh-oh, brain shorting out again. Need more caffeine.
Lisa Bang.
I'm the kitty corner.
The me and team.
I will be your committed trading partner on our continent together, for now.
And special co-host, Paradigm Shifter.
Join the Scrabble group.
And this has been White Oak.
I would just work mines, and I can work mines, and otherwise work cottages.
Ooh.
It's going to get really expensive.
So who would like to do the summary for Research Lab, because it's so many words? Man, people want to do the longer summaries.
I heard Lisa. Lisa volunteered.
Okay. In the Research Lab, we explored the topic of no more internal wonders.
Okay. I thought for a moment you said internal wonders rather than eternal, but...
Yeah, I thought so too as well.
Oh, really? I can say it again.
I wouldn't take wonders internally. External use only.
So, in the research lab, we explored the topic of no more internal wonders. Oh, God, I suck. So, in the research lab... Okay, let's try this again.
If you're not able to make it tonight, which of course might be understandable because God knows normal people have other plans for Saturday night. But
you call this unnormal.
I do not take offense to that assertion.
This isn't going to make the outtakes then. I can properly swear now. I can swear like it's brilliant.
All right, I've got a blooper there with Kieran swearing. Thanks to the backup recording.
I can't forget that thing's on.
Record date?
June 5th, 2010.
Civilization 4, Warlords and Beyond the Sword, Sound Clips, copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.